Young kids all over America must have gobbled this shit up.
Homie.
That squirrel just went into that hole in the tree.
Upside down,
look,
though.
Look, his tail sticking out.
You see that part that looks like a tree
trussy,
moving?
If you will.
It's like if you took it and then flipped it upside down where the clit would be, right?
Yeah, see the trussy? That's the squirrel's tail. Oh. He just climbed on the tree and went zoop.
Yeah, he slipped right in there like he was at fucking a fun center for slides or something. I don't know.
That probably is the squirrel fun center.
Or it's the squirrel
What's
survival center. Probably just hanging out.
I want him to come out so you can see him.
I'm your host and spiritual guide, Sean Barber. I'm joined, as always, by our resident expert in death, Miss Nicole Jewett.
Hello.
And the man who knows nothing, Mr. Ethan Black!
Why did you age like 70 years when you were reading that?
I felt like
I was thinking epic rap battles of history.
Oh, you're kind of right, yeah. I was picturing myself standing atop a mountain, shouting down. Not to compare myself to God, but if that's a comparison you wanted to make, shouting my commandments unto the peoples.
Yeah. Is that what you're doing?
That's just what I pictured.
Interesting enough.
So if you want to call that godlike,
isn't that what we talked about a couple weeks ago? People proclaiming themselves as God and how they're not right in the head.
Yeah, aren't you going to, like, kill people? Or
I might start a cult.
Start skinning people for shits and giggles?
I know a couple MLMs you could join.
So today is another episode that I've been brewing up for quite a while.
A really long time.
Quite a while. This one's been in the work for some time. And I've just been waiting to get the perfect stories for it. And I think we've done it.
Because we had, like, one. That was so weird and random that
then,
we couldn't
then we
figure out
two.
What else to put with it.
All right.
And then, actually, at the beginning of Groovehaven, which is an ensemble that Ethan and I play in, I found the third one. And so that's what we're going to get into. So we're going to go for a little walk through 20th century Illinois, which I know is really random, but all of these stories just tell the evolution of America in the 20th century. And so I think it's going to be really
interesting. Through the lens of Illinois.
Yeah, I think it's going to be
enough.
Really interesting to kind of go through and see what the fuck was going on in America in the 20th century. So we're going to be talking about some Illinois bootleggers, the Chicago Dojo Wars, and the Chicago Disco Riots.
Fucking Chicago.
Which are, it's going to go in order from the start of the 1900s up until the end. So it's going to be like that whole spectrum of time going on, like before World War II all the way up to about the 1980s. So we're going to get that whole spectrum of things that were going on. So, like, I hope you enjoy hearing these stories because I think it's going to be really interesting.
Yeah, I don't know shit about Illinois.
History. Like, everything has to do with, like, overarching, like, cultural movements and, like, historical events
but
that
it's
just
these
happen
one
to spark
specific events.
Weird things.
Yeah, so it's really cool. After listening, go check us out on Instagram at RuleOf3333 and on Facebook at RuleOf3Podcast. Make sure you keep stroking our egos. I love when we see those little follower numbers go
up. Oh, yeah, especially when it's people we don't know.
Yeah.
Like, we get a lot of followers that are, like, our friends that want to help us out, but it's neat when we see other people. No, you're Gen Z.
As a Gen Zer.
We're Gen Z?
Yes.
Oh, what?
We're, like, the very beginning of Gen Z.
As a Gen Zer, it strokes my ego to no end to see that follower number go up. So make
I'm
sure
an influencer.
You keep influencing my God complex, which I already have.
Also
apparently.
Already have, yeah.
We've got three tales from the Windy City, three dumbass hoes, and no fucking clue what we're doing. This is Rule of Three.
Today, when we think back to the Roaring Twenties and the effects of Prohibition, it's easy to think only of the speakeasies, bootleggers, and gang violence that we learn about in big cities. In Illinois, the first thought about the Prohibition era is often the infamous gangsters like Al Capone, who seized this opportunity to completely take over Chicago. But meanwhile, in the southern part of the state, the chaos of Prohibition rivaled that of the gang warfare in the city.
Did you guys ever read Al Capone Does My Shirts?
What?
No.
No? What?
No.
This is one of my favorite books back in elementary school, I think it was. It's this story about this kid who grows up on Alcatraz. His dad is the warden, I think. And it's this story about all these gangsters that are there, and Al Capone is this super friendly guy, which I think started the inspiration in my mind of learning about fucked up people, because in my mind, Al Capone was a nice, friendly guy who brought him soup.
Yeah,
so he's kind of dope. I wanted to learn more about nice, friendly Al Capone. Only later did I realize that Al Capone would murder people. Yeah. So
I feel like, I don't know if this is correct, but I want to say that I saw Al Capone's cell at Eastern State Penitentiary.
Wow.
Yeah, it was decked out.
That's cool.
It was crazy. He had like a satin seat and everything. It was actually kind
of
cool.
And if you play Mob of the Dead, you're in Alcatraz anyway. So there
exactly.
you go. Hell yeah.
Yeah.
So taking a little bit of a journey outside of Chicago, Southern Illinois was the territory of the Moonshiners, with hundreds of moonshine stills covering the rural area, and it was known for its rough crowd. Even before Prohibition, the area had gotten itself a reputation for violence and murder, usually stemming from feuds among rival families and labor disputes. The Heron coal mine strike in 1922, better known as the Heron Mine Massacre, left 23 people dead, and Prohibition did nothing for Bloody Williamson County but escalate the violence.
I love that strikes used to be a thing, you know, like a real thing. We hear about strikes today, and it's like some nerdy Google employees standing outside of their office. I miss the days when strikes were coal miners with their pickaxes and dynamite.
And they were, like, rioting.
Yeah, really getting work done. I also have watched The Irishman twice in, like, the past 2 weeks, so I might be going a little crazy for Jimmy Hoffa, but...
There was a strike at BIW over the summer, and, like, literally all they did was stand outside all the buildings with signs,
like,
and people would honk at them
come
as
on,
they went by.
Do
and they
something.
Got paid for it. Like, they got, like, strike compensation for
strike
it. It
money.
Was, like, a fraction of their normal pay, but still.
I don't know, blow up a boat or something.
I think that's terrorism.
Not when you're striking. That's called being...
domestic terrorism.
Protection of the unions.
A unionist.
I don't think that lines up perfectly, but I'm not a scientist.
Listen,
so.
Ask Jimmy Hoffa, all right?
Yeah, will I?
You can't, because he's dead, and nobody knows how or why and where he is. So good luck. If you can ask Jimmy Hoffa, you will solve one of the biggest mysteries in American crime history.
I'll probably run into him like a diner.
You might,
some old guy.
You might.
Probably.
Hanging out.
That would happen to you,
yeah,
of all
I'd
people. Pretty soon, there was a definite divide between the two rival organizations that ran this area, the Bootleggers, led by the Shelton Gang, and the Ku Klux Klan.
I wasn't expecting that one.
Yeah, they are.
For some reason, I was like, oh, who are these guys going to be? Some stupid tough name? Oh, it's the KKK. Perfect.
Yeah. America's bloodiest gang, the Shelton Gang, was a family affair, led by Carl Shelton and his brothers, Bernie and Earl, who spearheaded the distribution of booze all throughout Southern Illinois. They basically ran Williamson County, getting themselves above the law by paying off local officials and police.
We love a good family business.
Gotta love it. All
yeah,
in the family.
Good.
Yeah. On the opposing side, the emergence of the second generation Klan, who thought of themselves as the morality police, often butted heads with the Shelton Gang and highly disapproved of their effect on the area. They stood for everything they deemed to be quintessentially American, rallying behind Protestants, whites, prohibition, and law and order, and despised anything that was outside their doctrine, let alone anyone who openly acted against it.
The KKK is also a family business, but a much more inbred family than you would normally choose to support.
I feel like it's not really much of a business more than a collection of weirdos and fools.
A family.
A school of thought.
School of thoughts.
The KKK, in this area, was made up of many prominent local officials, and they hated the Shelton Gang and the way they made a mockery of their beloved law and order. They took it upon themselves to raid bars where they thought they would find hidden moonshine stills, often beating the patrons and stealing their money and other valuables. So they were kind of like vigilante police. They
minus the police part. They
yeah,
were just
exactly.
vigilantes who didn't do anything good.
They thought that all this stuff was their responsibility because they didn't agree with it. So they had all the power and authority to go and shut it down themselves.
But they didn't shut anything down. They just beat and mugged people.
That's true.
And
they
didn't
really
find
did.
Anything wrong.
I know we've been drawing a lot of comparisons this episode, me to God and whatnot.
Yeah.
But I would also, if you would like to draw your own comparison between the KKK defending law and order and somebody else who has been spouting the terms law and order over the past 4 years and beating black people and others in order to defend law and order, you can go ahead and do that if you so choose.
You can draw a lot of parallels between the 1920s and the 2020s.
I'm not going to say what old orange guy that just recently left a major city on the East Coast, But you could certainly come up with an orange old guy who just recently left a major city on the East Coast.
I don't know where Chester Cheeto's at, but...
I was going to say something about Hulk Hogan again, but...
Oh, I was thinking Chester and Tony the Tiger. We are on completely different wavelengths. You were thinking people, yes. I was thinking characters.
So the Klan certainly did not do any favors for their reputation by busting into all these speakeasies and... kicking asses and taking names.
Not
Nobody
only are they
really
racists, they're just crooks.
They're just bad
people. Who would
have
thought?
And there was a sizable portion of the population that was made up of the blue-collar working class that disagreed with Prohibition and were directly affected by the labor strife and unemployment that riddled the area. And they used alcohol as a distraction from their everyday troubles. Like, they had hard lives. They were laborers. They just wanted
coal
a little
miners.
Something
we
to relax and, like, exactly. So they didn't really approve of Prohibition either. So this is a really, really divided area that you had a lot of people on both sides.
Maybe if more people today knew about the history of the KKK and how they didn't like alcohol, it would be much less popular today than
maybe.
I'm just saying, I think we need to, as American citizens, do our part to educate America on how the worst crime the KKK has apparently committed is enforcing Prohibition. Which I think is something all Americans can get behind is not cool.
Because at this point, we think it's kind of ridiculous. I mean, I do. Like, what did they really think that was going to do?
I always thought Prohibition was weird. Just
kinda
let people
dumb,
drink.
Right?
Like, just, yeah. What are they going to do?
Listen,
get drunk? Oh, well. Like,
if my mom wants to toss back a margarita on the porch after work, the KKK is not going to stop her. You hear me?
I kind of think about it, though, as, like, what we're going through right now, like, legalizing marijuana... was basically kind of what they were going through with alcohol. Like,
yeah.
It was something that was dangerous, and it did kill people, and it did have bad, like, bad things happen when you misused it. But was that really a reason to keep it from everybody?
I wonder if we're going to run into, like, a marijuana prohibition kind of thing, where a bunch of states legalize it, and then a bunch of laws are passed to kind of peel back
some of that. Like federal laws, you mean?
Yeah, like, maybe even just state-level laws, though, to, like, they pass it, it doesn't... like really work the way that people think it's going to necessarily. Some new people get elected and repeal all of those laws and stuff. I just wonder if that's what we're in for. I don't know.
Yeah.
Probably is. Government's a cycle of repetition.
Repetition.
Some of the most prominent examples of the pinnacle of the Klan's rage was their siege of the Heron Hospital, where injured bootleggers were being taken to and cared for after, it didn't really say what happened, but I'm assuming it was like some sort of violence that like escalated to the
incidents.
Point where, the bootlegging incidents, it happens. They don't have bootlegging insurance.
Miscellaneous
so,
causes.
Yeah, so they were at the hospital. The Klan raided and attacked the hospital on February 8th, 1924. And then again, 2 years later, they held an election day rampage that killed gangsters and Klansmen. It really was deadly for both of them.
When you are the one storming hospitals, you know you're on the right side of history.
Of course.
Yeah.
Unfortunately for the Klan, they were unable to recover from this blow to their numbers. So, I mean, they killed themselves by doing this.
Oh, darn.
So,
I wish they finished the job.
By the time this had ended, they didn't have enough people to carry on their organization with the strength they had before. So, for a while, the Shelton gang was able to just run buck wild all over the place with no hindrance, doing whatever they wanted.
Perfect.
The Shelton gang ran dozens of illegal establishments that operated as speakeasies where drinking and gambling took place practically in plain sight with no one around to stop them. And the local officials were unable to appease the people who were calling for them to declare martial law to stop this because a lot of those like politicians and local officials were on payroll from the money they were bankrolling, which was about $2 million a month.
Ooh.
Back in the 20s,
damn,
they were making
son.
Fucking bank.
It was like $200 million.
Damn. Yeah. Despite this period of uninhibited success, the Shelton gang was rocked in 1926 when prominent member Charles Berger attempted to overthrow the gang, eventually striking out on his own and starting to make trouble. So something that I thought was kind of interesting was before Prohibition, like this is a coal mining area, the Shelton gang had a lot of competition with Berger and his gang that he had on his own.
The Berger boys.
His posse.
Mm-hmm.
Because they wanted control over the coal fields.
Of course.
And so after Prohibition came around and the KKK came around, they both kind of, like, the Shelton gang and Berger kind of, like, had this common enemy that they kind of joined together to fight for.
The enemy of my enemy is a racist, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
One of those things.
So they kind of joined forces, and after Prohibition ended,
they didn't really have anything to, like,
fight
the KKK over. Yeah. Like, after the KKK was gone, they were just kind of, like, hanging out.
That's why in Star Wars, it's so important that the rule of two was established after...
Rule of three?
Rule of two is so important, because after one of the Galactic Wars, when the Sith pretty much beat the pants off of the Jedi, there's a bunch of infighting. And so Darth Bane realized that the only way to make the Sith strong was to completely destroy the whole organization. And so he lured all of these Sith masters down into a tunnel where he used an ancient Sith ritual called the Thought Bomb and basically killed them all and trapped their consciences in, like, this orb thing. And then he started the rule of two. So there's only one master and one apprentice at any time. So the organization never got big enough for any infighting to happen. Like, it was always just a small core of power, and nobody was, like... The plan was basically the apprentice would kill the master at some point, so the backstabbing was going to happen, but that was part of the plan. Mm. And that's why it was so efficient and able to overthrow the Republic after the Clone Wars.
Damn, that's crazy. If only the Sith weren't fucking nutcases.
If only that had anything to do with the bootlegging in Illinois.
Yeah, my comment's going to be a lot less interesting. I was going to say, in that case, why didn't we just let gangs run over the whole country until the KKK was just gone forever? Because if
that's
Illinois backwater hippies, not hippies, hope, no, not hobos, Hicks.
There you go.
There we go. It's confusing a bunch of words.
Hickies?
Those could fucking do it because they're fighting about anti-alcohol reasons. What the hell is the rest of the country doing?
Yeah, so anyway, back to the story. What happened was after their common enemy was gone, they started butting heads again. And eventually Berger kind of like struck out on his own and was like, fuck you guys, I'm going to take over. And so that's what he did. His new faction fought viciously with the Shelton Gang for the privilege of controlling Southern Illinois' bootlegging operation, fighting in homemade armored cars, dropping DIY bombs out of planes, and dueling with an arsenal that dwarfed that of the actual police. So this was not just like they were fighting.
How the hell did you bombs back in the 20s?
I don't know.
I feel like they were dropping them out of airplanes. Like, I would be more confused where the fuck they got the airplanes.
I wouldn't. Apparently, it's not that hard to steal a fucking airplane and get away with it, as we learned a couple weeks ago.
You got a good point. This feud finally came to an end when the Shelton brothers were convicted of an unsolved robbery of $15,000 and spent 25 years in prison.
How were they convicted of an unsolved robbery?
Well,
what did that make it
solved? It was unsolved for a long period of time until then.
Oh, okay.
And that when they... pinned it on the...
So unsolved until completed.
I thought the police came around and was like, we can't solve this robbery.
So it was your fault. No. Without their leaders, the gang all but dissolved, while Charles Berger took control of bootlegging up until 1928, when he was executed for ordering the murder of Mayor Joe Adams.
Berger strikes back.
Why didn't he just do it? I feel like, why you gotta order?
Yeah, he hired two, like, underlings to do it for
him. Why don't you hire, like, I don't know, actual hitmen or something? I don't know. They probably existed back
then.
If
you want a job done right,
you gotta do it yourself.
Apparently the cops don't care enough about it, because then they just took bribes. Why don't you just pay a cop to kill the mayor? That's quick and easy. A man on the inside, boom, overdone with.
Or you could pay the mayor enough to just kill himself.
Or drop a fucking bomb on them, because apparently those were easily accessible things that you could just make out of fucking twig, rock, crafting table, bomb. That's what I've learned.
With the end of Prohibition, the Shelton Gang was forced to move on from dealing illegal alcohol, and they kind of just dissipated into local, like, surrounding cities
into
to
jobs.
Control the gambling scene.
Oh, okay.
So that was still something that wasn't, it was kind of taboo to gamble and stuff.
The bookie market.
So they started doing that. The Shelton boys mostly met their untimely ends at the hands of the violence they surrounded themselves with Charles and Bernie both being murdered within a year of one another. Ernie, on the other hand, survived several attempts on his life.
Dude, fucking Ernie.
Everybody's out to get Ernie. Shit.
I mean,
he was, like, almost murdered three different times.
Oh, my God.
And evidently, he was scared straight since he fled to Florida and lived out the rest of his life in peace there until he passed away at 96.
Ernie's the main character of an anime because he's, like, really weak and pathetic, right? And he's like, oh, I'm Ernie. And everyone's trying to kill him. You know, they think he's a small shit.
Yeah, and then he
fucking hits him with, like, an atomic suplex. And then he just defeats all his enemies. And that's how he was able to do it.
We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're on to the Chicago Dojo Wars. Our second story really tells the tale of karate in Eastern culture coming to the Western world, and centers around one of the most interesting characters in 20th century America, John Keegan, also known as Count Dante. John Keegan was born to a wealthy Irish family in Chicago, Illinois, on February 2nd, 1939. His father was both a physician and the director of the Ashland State Bank, so he was absolutely rolling in the dough.
How do you become a doctor and, like, a bank manager?
I don't know. I don't know.
What?
Honestly, this might have been start of World War II. People are getting deployed. There's, like, two men left in Chicago, yeah. So you have to just start doing random things.
I'm wondering if he maybe, like, inherited the bank position,
maybe, yeah.
But also, you know, had dreams of becoming a doctor.
He was just an accountant who knew CPR. That's all it really required in Illinois.
His family was incredibly well off, though. Like, this wasn't new money or anything. Like, they were an old, established Irish, like, immigrant family. They were the real deal.
Yeah, so I'm wondering if he just kind of inherited the bank.
His mother was more on the social side of things. She would make many appearances in the Chicago papers and tabloids and was like the talk of the town kind of gal, you know?
Mm-hmm.
John took an interest in fighting sports from a young age, joining Johnny Coolin's 63rd Street Gym, where he learned boxing during high school. Out of high school, John joined the Marine Reserves and then transferred to the Army. He never saw any active duty, but while in the service, he learned even more combat skills, including jiu-jitsu, which had been introduced to the U.S. military after fighting in the Pacific Islands. Now, we think of sports like karate and jiu-jitsu as pretty normal today. Mm-hmm. Like, I even did karate as a kid. I was pretty shit at it. But, like, if Sean Barber from upstate New York has done karate, then it's not
it's
all that.
Common.
It's not weird anymore. But in the 1950s, these martial art forms were something from another planet entirely. Yeah. America had never seen anything like it.
Asia.
Like we've discussed many times on this podcast, the 1950s were a time of cultural change in the U.S., heavily influenced by U.S. soldiers coming back from the war in the Pacific and bringing Asian cultural ideas with them. This spurred on many of the most famous cults in history, including Scientology, and started a new wave of natural beliefs.
Eastern medicine.
Another byproduct Origami. Of this cultural exchange was martial arts making their way to the States. One of the people most influential in bringing martial arts to America was Robert Trias, who served in the Navy and was stationed near the Solomon Islands for much of the war. While there, he became close with a local man named Tung Sing, who was a small man who traveled around preaching Buddhism. Tung enjoyed watching Robert train as he was a high-level boxer. He was actually, like, the middleweight champion of the Navy. Like, this guy, Robert was the real fucking deal. Like, he would train boxing all the time and beat the crap out of people. But Tung kept asking to spar with Robert. Now, Robert refused again and again.
He was this tiny little feeble old man.
He's a little Buddhist missionary. And Robert felt bad about beating the fucking daylights out of the guy.
You never underestimate old people.
But one day, he finally gave in and agreed to fight Tung in a match. Robert was fully prepared to easily knock Tung out, but before he knew it, Robert was on the ground.
Robert paralyzed from the waist down. Tung severed his fucking brains down. Game, set, match. Never saw Tung again.
Oh, fatality.
It wasn't that bad. But Robert did describe the fight as being the biggest thrashing of his life. And this is a guy who's grown up boxing and learned
middleweight champion of the
Navy. And this 60-year-old guy whooped his ass in the worst beating he ever received in his life.
Well, you guys have seen Ant-Man, right? The smaller you are, the denser your fists
are. That's exactly how it
is. So, like,
yeah.
You know, my punch
pressure.
Versus, like, you know, the tiny man's punch. It's like rock meets moving car. Like, it's just no comparison.
That's like Uncle Iroh in Avatar. Mm. Like, he's this quiet, unassuming guy. But the second Zuko
beat
starts
the shit
getting
out of
a little feisty, Iroh will knock some sense into the man.
Exactly.
And then serve you tea afterwards because he's a gentleman.
Absolute baller.
And so Robert was immediately curious about what on earth had just happened that knocked him to the ground so hard. Like, what did this guy just do to him?
An illusion spell.
Little did Robert know, but Tung was way more than a missionary. He was also a practitioner of Shuri Ryu and was practically born into martial arts royalty. From a young age, Tung was taught this style from his uncle, Master Shang So Sing, and he later met with one of the greatest masters of all time, Choki Motobu, and the two of them exchanged their knowledge to create one of the most efficient and effective forms of hand-to-hand combat. All of this is to say that Robert should not have felt too bad about getting stomped on by a 60-year-old guy, because he was the real deal.
Yeah.
After the match, Robert knew that he had encountered something truly special and begged Tung to train him. The pair trained together secretly for the rest of Robert's deployment, as any practice of martial arts was banned under the U.S. occupation.
Why?
The U.S. occupation of Okinawa was brutal. Okinawa is where some of the most deadly fighting in all of World War II took place. Like, you think, oh, Normandy was a big battle. No, nothing compared to Okinawa. Like, 20,000 people died on this tiny little island.
That's crazy.
Because it was the gateway to Japan. If they conquered Okinawa, then Japan was, like, the next island over. And so Japan defended that to the very last man. It was the single bloodiest area of land in all of World War II. And so when the U.S. finally took it over, they ruled it with an iron fist. Like, all aspects of Asian culture were banned from the island. They didn't want anybody practicing martial arts, nothing. And so they had to train in secret, or else not only would Tong probably be killed, but Robert, who knows what would have happened to him? Like, yeah. A Navy man.
Traitor.
Practicing. Yeah, exactly. Man. That's what it would have been. When his time in the Pacific was up, Robert thanked Tong endlessly for the training and brought his new knowledge back with him to the U.S. in 1945. In Phoenix, Arizona, Robert opened up the first dojo in the United States. Now, back in Chicago, John Keegan was thoroughly enjoying this explosion of martial arts and trained in many dojos, learning multiple styles over the year. John and Robert ended up meeting, and John studied under the father of American karate for a few years, earning his black belt and becoming a sensei himself. In 1962, John was made Midwest Director of the United States Karate Association, which was led by Robert. Now, I'm sure it wasn't all that hard to rise up in the ranks of this thing.
Because it was nothing, yeah.
Yeah, karate had like just
gotten its
legs. And they
were like homies.
But yeah, this just goes to show that they were getting pretty close together. Robert trusted him to lead part of his organization.
Just imagine how much further he would have gotten if he wasn't scared of beating the shit out of the old man, like, 2 months before. Like, if he wasn't pushing it off for so long, and like he did it earlier, he would have been kicking ass even more.
Together in 1963, John and Robert held the first national martial arts tournament in America called the First World Karate Tournament, which that's so American, just to hold a national thing and call it the World Tournament.
First.
Like, oh my God,
yeah.
Come on.
Is that where Karate Kid was filmed?
Maybe. But we're going to get to in a second just how much this, like, emulates the Karate Kid.
This reads like a movie script.
It does. It really does.
I mean, you think the Karate Kid was original?
I mean,
probably watched
this
shit.
Like, is fighting abroad and he meets this little unassuming old man who he begs to teach him karate. Yeah. And then there's a tournament. And
I thought you meant fighting abroad. I was like, why are you dueling it out with? I was like, what are you fighting? Like, why are you doing that? That's.
Nicole's just
abroad.
Out here beating women on the streets.
I was going to say, like, geez, like, that's unfortunate.
Oh my God. The event was hosted at the University of Chicago, and to the dismay of many, the tournament was entirely full contact at the insistence of John Keegan. Now, karate tournaments don't run like normal boxing matches that you would think of. Most tournaments don't actually have participants striking each other. To practitioners of karate, it's more important that you prove that you have control over your actions and what you're doing is well thought out rather than just hitting the other guy harder. Like,
yeah.
That's not really the point of it. The point of it is to have nice fluid movements that you are thinking out.
Mm.
However, John insisted on the full contact, and this started a rift between him and many of the other masters in the U.S. After the tournament, it seemed that the once close relationship between John and Robert was fading, and in 1964, John started his own group, the World Karate Federation, severing ties with his previous sensei. And again, the whole, the world karate, no.
Because this is totally where karate is the only place it's ever been practiced. Like,
suburban
really?
Chicago is the world's hub of martial arts.
It's not like it just... You didn't take it from another country relatively recently in history, really?
Also, anything with federation in it, it's evil. It's going to be evil.
Yeah.
You're always the antagonist in anything
That's
you're
true.
Ever... If you have federation in your title, you're the bad guy.
Again, in the Clone Wars, the Trade Federation is bankrolling the Separatists.
Exactly, like...
Life is Star Wars.
If I have to listen to you two Separatist sympathizers.
Now, on his own, John continued promoting his full contact tournaments and opened his own dojo in Chicago. Predictably, the style of karate that John taught was harsh and dirty, far removed from the traditional practices found in Asia.
Now, this is where it sounds exactly like the Karate Kid.
This
you know,
is
when
where
he,
we're
like,
watching the Karate Kid.
He
yeah.
goes to the dojo to, like, learn karate,
yeah.
and they don't want him, and it's, like, the evil guy that just wants them to, like, beat the snot out of each other
yeah.
and stuff.
John's the
That's
evil guy.
Him.
I,
this is John.
He's got federation.
He's that sensei.
He's the federation. I'm telling you, it's... staple.
John wanted nothing to do with the ceremonies or patience taught by many of the fighting styles found traditionally in Asia. He simply wanted the best way to beat the crap out of somebody else. And he was quite violent outside of the dojo, too. Karate back in these days was a widely unregulated and somewhat mystical activity. And people like John realized that there was a lot of money to be made if you could get students in your dojo.
Yeah.
There's a tradition in karate called dojo arashi, or dojo storming, in which students from one dojo will go to another and challenge the members there. This is a way for dojos to gain students in popularity, but in the US, it also meant fear and territory. Essentially, if your dojo was defeated by some challengers, you lost that territory and the population around it. John was one of the first people in the area to realize how profitable it could be to have a large territory to yourself. So he started targeting other dojos in some less than honorable ways.
What do you mean, like with guns?
In 1965, a drunk John Keegan was arrested while trying to blow up the front of a rival dojo with a stick of dynamite. And he was arrested with attempted arson, possession of explosives, and resisting arrest. He wasn't even man enough to go in there and challenge the other sensei. He just wanted to blow it up and call it a day.
I feel like using dynamite should be considered more than arson.
Yeah.
I feel like that should be a lot more things
than... That's like
than,
terrorism.
That's domestic terrorism. Yeah.
Also, I was thinking about it. We should start putting that rule into frats.
Yes!
So frats
and
sororities
so right.
have
like
to fucking
that.
Duke it out.
Yeah.
And then there's like.
Or they like win a beer pong tournament and they're like, this is my house now.
No.
I want hand to hand combat. I gotta
see Chad swing on somebody. Yeah, I gotta see it happen. Like, it's gonna go down.
And it's gonna be like those old medieval movies where the two armies are out there and then they bring forth their two best fighters.
Yeah, and then it's like Fight Club circle. And then you like regulate every tournament.
Whichever one wins the fight, like, you don't have to fight the rest of the battle. Like, that stands for the army, you know?
Exactly.
Oh, man, I'm really hyped for this now.
I think that'd be cool. We should, petition. I don't know how to
we
do that.
We should contact some local fraternities.
Who's the frat or sorority king and queen?
1967 was a big year for John Keegan, as it was the first year that he became his true self, legally changing his name to Count Juan Rafael Dante.
Why?
And just claimed to be a descendant of a Spanish noble family that was forced out of Spain during the Spanish Civil War. Couple issues. He was most definitely not Spanish. Mm-hmm. His family was Irish.
You mean Keegan is not Irish?
But that's a minor detail, not being Spanish. Where's the real problem lie?
Okay, here we go.
Spain doesn't have a count and countess system, so even if he was a noble, that wouldn't be his title. And Dante is an Italian last name. So John kind of half-assed this one.
I don't even think that's half. He didn't. He just asked.
He no-assed it.
He just asked. Full
and
ass.
Ate that best. An eighth of an ass.
Yeah.
Just at least.
Regardless, Count Dante was born, and he leaned into it hard.
That's so embarrassing.
I know, Count Dante.
Wow.
That's crazy.
Dante began publishing a pamphlet called The World's Deadliest Fighting Secrets.
Again with the world shit.
I know.
I mean, I got a World's Deadliest Fighting Secret. Have a knife hidden. Stab somebody. Boom, they can't see it.
Bitch.
Like, use a nuke. They're not going to see it coming. What do you mean?
And he advertised this pamphlet in comic books all over the country, calling himself the deadliest man who ever lived.
No, the world? Just whoever lived.
He's not even a real man.
And he would spout all kinds of bullshit that he traveled to Thailand and China and that he would fight in these secret death tournaments.
Mortal Kombat?
Yeah, basically, in which, like, two opponents would fight each other to the death, and, like, it would be this whole tournament, and he would win all of these, and that there would be thousands of people watching, which...
How secret are they if thousands
of
people
right?
are watching?
Well, it's a secret membership.
And nothing like this ever happened. Again, this is such an Americanized version of martial arts, where it's all about death and killing and being the strongest fighter. In China, fucking... 80-year-old grandmas practice this shit.
It's, Tai Chi.
It's not about violence and fighting. It's about patience and finding, like, inner balance and knowing yourself. That's what it's about. It's not about fighting. This is just what John turned it into because he knew he could sell it to Americans.
He's the antagonist, I'm telling you.
He absolutely
antagonists
is.
Always take things that are meant for more spiritual purposes and make it all about power and big dick and other people. And oh, look at
with
me, I killed
like
people for fun.
Count Dante, of course, he's the black and red character.
Yeah.
That I've had that in my head this whole time, and I just was able to verbalize it. Like
the name Dante also comes basically translates to like the dance of death.
Yeah.
Which,
I just think of, like, Dante's Inferno.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
It's all, like, demonic and, like, evil.
That's so fucking cheesy. The dance of death. Young kids all over America must have gobbled this shit up, though, because Count Dante found himself quite wealthy, and he used that money to open up even more dojos across Chicago. At this point, Dante had basically been disavowed by anybody in the karate community that took themselves seriously, mm-hmm. and anybody who actually studied this had nothing to do with him at
yeah.
this point. He still was holding his full contact tournaments, which were described as basically low-level boxing matches just there for the bloodshed. Dante had feuds with practically everyone around him, and he had a hell of a temper. He was known for getting into fights for nothing at all, and surrounded himself with karate masters that were much more interested in street fights than actually practicing.
That's not surprising considering he tried to blow up a dojo when he was drunk.
He probably keeps very peaceful company.
I'm sure
really
he's very calm and
if
perfect.
The like antagonist and the Karate Kid was actually based on this
Maybe.
Guy, I would not be surprised. Yeah.
The culmination of his bad attitude and ego came on March 24th, 1970 at the Green Dragon Society's Black Cobra Hall, which I just love. That's how you name anything to do with karate.
That's
or
dragon
or Asian,
and cobra.
Asian culture is just scary reptilian-like animal color. That's,
yeah.
That's all you got to
yeah.
do to make
yeah.
something
the
Asian.
Green Dragon.
I've got the gold dragon in my old hometown. That's
you
where,
do.
That's where you'd get your Chinese takeout is a golden dragon. Yeah.
Fucking love takeout.
Mm.
Mm.
Taking out thoughts. Gut punch. Suplex.
Dante had beef with one of the students there. No one is really sure what exactly the issue was.
How do you have beef with a student?
Well, one of his friends thinks that it had something to do with a girl that Dante was seeing and this other guy was kind of involved with her, but nobody really knows what it was.
So, like,
there was no good reason. No good reason.
We kind of think about, like, kids or karate students, but, like, these could have been adults.
These
too.
Were
like,
adults,
it could
yeah.
have been an adult.
Oh,
that
I
was
picturing some. That's why
he
I laughed
just wasn't
about it.
A sensei, so he was a student.
Yeah.
Oh, that makes
he
sense.
He was learning
yeah.
karate, but he was an adult.
That makes sense.
Dante called up two of his best fighters, Jimmy Konsevich and Michael Falkoff, to come with him and brought a few more of his students for the fight.
Because if you're so tough, you need backup, right?
That's, of course.
Exactly.
Yeah, that
the
makes sense.
The group went on a dojo arashi to the Green Dragon Society, and Dante issued his challenge. He kicked the door in.
Oh.
And he's a little bit startled to see that a lot of the advanced students were in the dojo.
He thought he was busting into the kiddie class.
He clearly planned on just jumping this one guy and
yeah.
ganging up on him. But all of a sudden, Dante had a real fight on his hands. Not one to back out of a fight, though. Dante ran right in, and the fight began. One of Dante's men hit a green dragon in the eye with a nunchuck. And Dante went after one of the instructors, hitting him in the eye so hard that he would later require extensive surgery for the
That's
laceration.
That's also, like, really good proof that they're not even, like, fighting fair.
No.
They're, like, going for their eyes and stuff like that. Like, they're not even just fighting.
Oh, that's what Dante's whole pamphlet was full of. Like, eye gouging and pulling ears and, like, hooking lips and stuff. That's what it was full of. It wasn't full of any actual traditional
like relevant
karate.
Fighting
it
tips.
Was full of just street fighting, basically.
Yeah.
And he just put on a black gi, and so people would like, oh, he's a karate master. It was just street fighting that he put Asian names on because it would sell.
Yeah.
That's
and
all
boy
he was
did
doing.
It.
While many masters dismiss Dante as a bloodthirsty lunatic, he was a very effective fighter, and he knew how to pummel somebody. Jimmy Konsevich attacked one green dragon from behind, and in an effort to protect himself, the green dragon grabbed a Chinese sword off of the wall. The man claimed that he was trying to block from Konsevich's attacks, but the next thing anyone knew, Konsevich had been stabbed in the stomach twice.
Cut in half, completely severed, sushied up.
Dante yelled to end the fight, and Konsevich stumbled out to the sidewalk, then fell on the ground and bled out. In the ensuing court case, Dante was acquitted of all charges, but the judge made it clear that he was a guilty man, and the death of his friend was certainly his fault.
No. Thank goodness that judge had fucking sense in his brain.
Yeah.
No, I love Dante, too. Oh, no, one of my guys was stabbed. Stop the fighting, please. It's like, no, you're getting stabbed all over.
It was a street brawl, and a lot of them were armed with Chinese weapons and stuff. Like, they were just brawling. This wasn't some high-level karate extraordinaire, like, fight to end all fights. It was just gang violence,
essentially. An ambush. It was just ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's a trap.
It was grown men fighting for no damn reason.
Yeah. Although Dante said he felt horribly guilty in that he would swear off violence, he would end up in many more fights. He simply just couldn't shake his violent nature. On May 25th, 1975, John, Count Dante Keegan, died of internal hemorrhaging in his sleep, surely spurred on by his addiction to pills and alcohol that he had developed after that day at the Green Dragon. While Count Dante was a violent, egotistical maniac, there's no denying that whatsoever. He did play a large role in introducing martial arts to America and was a fierce advocate for racial integration in the sport, the first person in the martial arts scene to do so. One of the big divides that happened between him and Robert, one of the reasons he ended up leaving, was that Robert, good guy, racist though. Mm-hmm. He didn't allow any black people into his tournaments or anything. He didn't allow any of them into his organization. But John didn't give a shit. He would train anybody, probably just for the money, but still, he trained African-Americans when nobody else would.
Yeah.
And so he would show up with all of his African-American students to these tournaments, which basically had like a de facto ban on African-Americans, but John didn't give a shit. And he fiercely advocated that his students be allowed to participate no matter their race. And that caused a big divide between him and a lot of other people. So good on him for that.
If only he wasn't a psychopath.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He wasn't a totally terrible person.
He was almost a good person. And Robert was also almost a good person.
Why can't Pete, like, there's just...
Can you just combine the two of them? Like, take the best of both of them and mash them together.
There's one crucial piece you're missing. And it's just like, you don't have to kill people for no reason.
Yeah.
And don't be racist.
But
those are two easily filled pieces.
Those are not hard to put together.
Yeah. I do
like,
both
those are
of those
not
things
difficult things.
Constantly in my life. I don't kill people, and I'm not racist.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I can breathe fine. I don't have broken toes.
My life
toes.
Is not a struggle.
My liver is perfectly, well, I don't know if it's perfectly fine, but like, I'm in
pretty
damn
good
shape.
I would probably say
being,
like 96% efficiency.
I'd say it's pretty
say.
Good, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, but like race relations were a big deal in post-World War II America. And as we'll see in our next story, nice little segue here, we were still figuring them out in the 1980s.
Oh, God.
So when we come back, we're going to
be... Are you kidding? We're still figuring that out today.
We yeah. are still figuring it out today, somehow. We're going to take a quick little break. When we come back, we have the Chicago Disco Riot for you.
That's cool.
This shouldn't come as too much of a surprise, but people in the 80s were racist. Not only were they racist, they were also homophobic, and this story goes to show how people back then and to this day express their hateful ideologies by targeting seemingly innocuous things. The story begins in the 1970s in Chicago with one bad baseball team, and I mean bad.
Awful, terrible baseball team.
The Chicago White Sox were a shitty team, and they especially sucked during the 70s, starting the decade off by going 56-106.
What a way to start off the 70s, baby. Ringing it in.
Yeah. They marginally improved over the next few years, placing third in their division in 1977, but by 79, things were going downhill again.
Over the 70s, they had a total of 2 years where they had a positive winning streak. That was it. That's how bad this
team
was. 2 out of 10.
But what was their KD? How many people did they claim? They were so bad because they weren't playing the game. They were beating the shit out of the other team.
Yeah, I'm sure that's what's happening.
In July of 1979, the White Sox were down bad. 33-45 bad, and that's not the kind of team people exactly rush out to see. The stadium they played in was Comiskey Park, which had the capacity to seat over 44,000 people, but throughout the season, the crowd rarely numbered over 10,000. This was a huge problem for Bill Veeck, the owner of the team, and his son, Mike Veeck, who is the promotions director. While the coaches are tasked with making the team perform well, it was the owner's job to turn a profit. And that's hard to do when nobody wants to come see your team get wiped 16-4, which happened just a month ago.
It was a normal sight to see the White Sox get absolutely
pummeled.
Blown out
yeah, ruled,
in a game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when you are in charge of running this as a business, you gotta do some pretty wacky shit in order to get people to the stadium, butts and seats. It's hard to get butts and seats when the seat is to watch your hometown team get a baseball bat shoved up their ass for four. I don't even know how long baseball games are, but
I guess
long,
there was a quote from, I can't remember if it was Bill or his son, who said, like, nobody wants to come see a shitty team just lose, but they will come see a shitty team for, like, a carnival.
Yeah.
So if you do something fun,
you have to
people will
show.
Come out.
Yeah.
Thankfully for the Vex, an opportunity came their way from an unlikely 24-year-old. Steve Dahl was a disc jockey from Chicago, and if there was one thing he was known for, it was his hatred of disco. Which seems very unrelated, but trust you, believe
it
you
all,
me,
it
it's related.
I love how that's what he was like known for. It's
yes.
Like, oh yeah, that guy, he hates disco. What's his name? Don't fucking know.
Just know
he hates disco.
In a couple minutes, you will realize why he was known for that.
And why he hates it.
Oh, is he the guy who wouldn't play disco songs on his radio or whatever?
We'll get there.
Okay.
Steve was born in California in 1954, and he took an interest in radio when he hit high school. At age 16, he dropped out of school and started working at a station full-time, lying to his parents that he was doing a work-study program for his school. At 18, Steve married a woman who called into his show, requesting the song Suzanne by Leonard Cohen, and then the two quickly got divorced.
Which is kind of funny, because the song is about a failed marriage. And so kind of should have had a little bit of heads up
prophecy.
On there, Steve.
Steve spent the next few years going job to job, but he never really landed anywhere solid. He was still enamored with his ex-wife, though, and he stalked her, sleeping outside of her house in his car. In 1976, she told him about an opening at a station in Detroit, probably just to get him the fuck away from her, but he managed to get the job, so off he went to Detroit.
Oh, good. Good for him.
Steve did pretty well here, gaining a decent following, and after 2 years, he got an offer to move to Chicago for a raise double his salary,
ooh.
So he accepted. Steve started his job at WDAI in February of 1978, but he struggled to find the same type of audience that he had in Detroit. After 10 months of mediocrity, the station had had enough and fired him on Christmas Eve as they moved towards hosting disco music.
Which is a little rough, I will say. Christmas Eve, come on.
They really couldn't have at least waited until, like, after Christmas
yeah.
to, like, have a happy
little,
holiday.
A little rough.
Yeah.
So this is something that was happening everywhere, and it was a really good move for the station. So they were all switching from rock to disco music as artists like Diana Ross, Casey and the Sunshine Band, Donna Summer, and the Village People were dominating the charts.
Mm-hmm.
The most popular artists of the day were black and gay artists, not groups that Middle America had been known to support openly.
We're not exactly known for our
acceptance.
Promoting of good health of marginalized communities here in America.
Exactly.
You mean giving a shit about people? Who would have thought?
Yeah. We're not great at that.
At this crossroads in American culture, a lot of white people thought that their identity was being taken over by black culture. And as we saw just this year, that makes people really violent.
This story is going to sound shockingly familiar to everything that's been going on the past 4 or 5 years. So if you get a little bit of PTSD, I don't blame you.
Of course, white rock culture wasn't going anywhere. Bands like Led Zeppelin, Queen, and AC/DC were still putting out some of their best work, but this didn't stop rock fans from feeling threatened and wanting to destroy disco. Steve Dahl was a part of this group that feared the way he saw America changing. When he landed his new job at WLUP in March, his biggest staple was trashing disco music of any kind.
I just like that station's acronym is WLUP.
WLUP.
WLUP. WLUP.
Wolp.
Wolp.
Wolp. There it is.
It's pretty good.
He started an organization called the Insane Coho Lips, which I ask me what that means. I have no fucking clue.
Insane Coho Lips.
And this was a mob of avid fans of rock and roll.
You mean racists?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, I was going to say, you
nice,
can be fans
nice.
Of rock and roll.
You picked up on that one. That
but
was good. Good
you
work.
You can't hate things because they're made from other people's races.
That's good. That's you not... picked up on it.
Mm. And they absolutely despised disco just as much as Steve did. And he would gather the cohos all over the city for events protesting disco. This all sounds insane for people to hate disco this much, but it was so much more than that. These people hated black artists and black culture and used disco as a way to express their racism and homophobia in a way that they couldn't really be condemned for because it wasn't blatant.
What are you going to say? Oh, I just don't like disco. It's not my type of music. You can't. Well, no, it's because you hate black people. No, I'm not a racist. How dare you say I'm racist? I just don't like disco. It's not my thing. And if that sounds familiar to what people say today,
it's
exactly
it
what people say today. Oh, how dare you call me a racist? I'm not a racist. I have a black friend. I'm not racist. I just don't like this.
Yeah.
I just feel like at the same time, if you don't like something, you don't have to protest it.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
I'm not a big fan of listening to gospel music in my own personal time. Do I hate gospel music? No, I think
you
it can be done
choose
really well.
Not to consume that type of media that you don't like, but you don't have to openly shit on it
exactly.
all the time.
And if someone played gospel music, I wouldn't be like, turn that shit off. I'd be like, oh, cool. Like, I don't listen to this, but it's how it goes. You know?
But again, it's that whole thing where it's not the music. It's the people that are making it.
It's the covert operation.
It's the same thing. Like, I don't know if like, Muslim prayer songs, for some reason, were at the top of the U.S. charts. Do you know the fucking uproar that would cause in America?
Unfortunately. Yeah.
And all it would just be like, why is this music being played? It's not the
this
music
is America.
We like.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's exactly what people say.
Like, well, obviously it is, because people in America put it at the charts somehow, some way.
Yeah,
exactly. And it was Americans that put this music on the top of American charts.
I feel like people who scream about being Americans are the least
patriotic.
The
people.
Least American.
Yeah,
I know.
Exactly.
They're the people that don't fucking remember that this is supposed to be the place that everyone is welcome.
That
was the foundation of our country, was that anyone could come here and be accepted and welcomed and have a fulfilling life.
They're the people that are flying the flag of a country that seceded from America.
Because they hated it.
Started an open rebellion against America and was defeated by America. Those are the
people. Same crowd.
In case anybody was confused.
And
that's what we're talking about.
This is absolutely not to excuse this kind of behavior, but to their credit, they probably didn't even realize that, like, that was their, like, internalized racism and misogyny. Like, to them, they just didn't like disco music.
They didn't know why.
Exactly. But, like, deep down, like, they knew it was their fear that their culture and their control was going to be taken away from them. And it was something they didn't understand, and a community they didn't identify with, and they didn't want that to be, like, a big thing in what they considered, like, their culture.
Which is reasonable. You don't have to protest
but
about it.
Exactly.
But, like,
you don't
that's
have to
everything
do this.
That happens today. Everything with, like, protests about, you know, like, police wearing body cameras or legalizing marijuana or, like, requiring voter IDs and stuff. It's not about any of that. It's not about any of that. It's about black people and black culture. And it's the fear that white people are going to lose control over America. That's what it's about. And that's what this was about, too. It wasn't about disco music just as much as it's not about voter IDs.
You hate to see it.
Mic drop.
Boom.
On his show, Steve would have, like, this little segment where he would, like, blow up disco records. And he would kind of, like, talk about them and then, like, play that little, like, explosion sound.
How petty do you have to be?
And that was his,
no, exactly.
like... That was one of his, like, segments on his morning show. And this gave Mike Vec, the promotions director of the White Sox, an idea.
Sparked a little light bulb in old Mikey's head.
Oh, yeah?
So in the summer of 1979, Mike approached Steve about holding an event at a White Sox game to draw more people to the stadium. Steve was immediately on board. You know, he just was a little disc jockey.
White Sox? You gotta go with
it. White Sox, white people.
White privilege. White
Sox.
There we go.
And together they came up with Disco Demolition Night, where if you brought a disco record with you to the stadium, you'd get in for 98 cents because Steve worked on 97.9, like that was the station.
And
so
they couldn't charge him 9/10 of a cent.
97.9
even
cents.
Even though they charge you that for gas.
That's kind of dope. That's kind of a dope idea
it
if it
it's
didn't stem
cool.
from an ugly place.
Yeah.
And if it didn't go so badly, this
oh,
might have been fun.
No.
And so between the two games, they were going to take all of those disco records that people had brought in, and their genius idea was to blow them up on the field.
Throw them all in a giant dumpster, which was thousands of them. Like thousands of people
and
brought records.
Blow them up.
And explode them.
And somehow they thought this was a good idea.
Well, was
somehow,
the bomb DIY or was it purchased?
Dynamite.
Oh,
somehow
okay,
they also thought they were going to be able to play a game on the same field after
this
they
was
just
a this was a double-header
night. It.
So they were going to have a game, you know, pause so the players could take a break and
half-time
everything.
Show.
This was going to be the entertainment.
Bomb.
Ignite a bomb on the field and play again.
Clean it up and play again.
Oh, well, dumpsters back then were sturdier.
It was already late at night. Like, by the time the first game had ended, it was like 8, 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
So they still planned on playing a whole other game after this.
Leading up to the event, though, Steve was actually genuinely worried that nobody was going to attend. He wasn't as popular as he once was in Detroit. He didn't have that same kind of following as he did. So he thought that nobody was going to show up and he was going to look like a failure.
Oh,
but
not again.
The owner, Bill Veeck, had a very bad feeling about what could happen. Because in 1974... the Cleveland Indians had hosted 10-cent beer night at one of their games, and that had ended horribly and caused the team to forfeit the game because of a crowd rioting. And this was essentially the same thing that was going to happen. They were going to let people in for insanely cheap. All of them were going to get
trashed. A shit ton of people were going to come.
Exactly. If you make beer cheap for white, middle-aged people to go get, guess what they're going to do?
Well... wasn't it just the entrance fee that was, like, cheaper?
Right, but, like, even if you can just get into the game for cheap and stuff and just go hang out with your buddies, drink a little bit, you know.
That's
like,
why you bump up the beer prices. You get in for 98 cents, but $4 for beer.
It would cost you out the ass to have any sort of refreshments.
You
want to
drink a beer? You're not going to have electricity for a night. A couple months.
Bill Veeck was actually in the hospital that week, but this was so important to him that he checked himself out of the hospital because he was so concerned about what could happen.
Why did he go to the hospital?
He was just having some routine testing. He was old.
Yeah.
So.
And it turns out Bill was right. The night of the game, July 12th, 1979, Comiskey Park was a mob scene. Tens of thousands of people had shown up, all with records in hand, thrilled to see disco blown to smithereens. None of these people were baseball fans. They were all here to save rock and roll. As people came into the stadium and handed over their records, one black usher noticed that tons of people didn't even have disco records. Instead, they were handing in funk, R&B, and Motown, basically anything by a black artist. When he asked his supervisor if he should still let these people in, the supervisor said, yeah, they just made a mistake. This was no mistake, though, at all.
Did they also forget their hoods at home?
No, remember the KKK is eradicated in this area.
No, they moved.
That's true. They probably still had a strong presence in Chicago.
What the fuck is it called? They time capsuled themselves.
Right. Oh, yes.
All the remaining KKK members dug a hole in the ground, and then they came out, and then they were here.
I love it.
It was no mistake, though. Not a single record blown up that night was by a white rock artist. This was specifically an attack on black, gay, and trans culture. No mistake about it whatsoever. In total, nearly 55,000 people crammed into the stadium, which had a max capacity of 44,000, remember? And there were nearly 20,000 more people outside of the stadium. They had to lock the gates to stop people from pouring in.
That's
and
crazy.
They didn't nearly hire enough security to
control
all these people.
They hired enough security for 35,000 people.
So they were about 20,000 people short of being able to control the crowd.
And a lot of that security wasn't even able to, like, be in the stadium. They were trying to stop people
from getting
pouring into the stadium still. And so they didn't even have that lack of security even inside of the stadium.
Yeah.
Most of it was outside of the stadium. The game that night was a doubleheader against the Detroit Tigers, and rookie Detroit pitcher Dan Petrie was shocked by just how passionate these Chicago fans were.
Aw, poor
Dan. He heard them chanting, "Let's go Sox," over and over, but what the crowd was actually chanting was Steve's signature slogan, "Disco Sucks."
Isn't that, like, the cutest, but most heartbreaking thing?
He was just like, I thought these fans were the best.
They were like, "Let's go Sox, let's go Sox," and the whole time they were just saying Disco Sox.
Maybe they were singing "Let's go Sox," and everyone.
Maybe they were.
Maybe it was confused.
This was just a big misunderstanding.
People had made huge banners with the slogan written out on that.
Let's go Sox.
Throughout the game, drowning out the sounds of a normal stadium. You couldn't hear the announcers
or anything.
You can
hear it on video. Like, this is recorded and stuff. Like, this is just
the
70s.
This was in 1979. This wasn't, like, back in the 50s or something. This is modern.
So we watched a video of this, and, like, the people storming the field and the announcers.
You can see the explosion and stuff. Like,
was it cool?
Not really, honestly. It was kind of a letdown.
It fucking
sucks. Not only are you going to be terrible people, but you can't even deliver a good show.
Yeah.
Like, that's scumbag material.
many people hadn't even turned over their records at the gate, and they began throwing them at the field during the game. So the records were like these deadly spinning discs, and players had to wear their hard batting helmets out on the field to avoid serious head injuries.
Talk about disco.
Think like Kung Lao's hat. God. Like, phew!
That's fatality.
Fucking... Also, I just like to imagine the irony, because usually it's like, oh no, like a fly ball, someone catches it in the audience. No, 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 the audience is giving the players gifts tonight.
And yeah, they had to pause this game multiple times, which is probably why it lasted so late into the evening, yeah. Because they had to stop the playing multiple times because people weren't just throwing discs on the field.
It was beer
bottles. They were throwing broken bottles, lighters.
Firecrackers.
Like, all
Both
kinds of things.
Both teams should have impromptu skeet shot. Like, pop! And, you know, see if you can
yeah,
nail
throw
it.
Throw the ball up in the air and see if you can hit anything with
yeah,
it.
Exactly.
Bat. Yeah,
exactly. Like one batter and then one pitcher from opposite teams, and they go and they try and hit you out of the air, and then you swap sides, and it's like score based.
So by the end of the first game, which the Sox lost 1-4, the crowd was bursting with energy, and something was about to happen. Then the man of the hour, the leader of this whole movement, Steve Dahl, rode out to center field in a Jeep, all dressed up in a military outfit.
Oh, wow.
It's like he knew what was about to go down.
He started the loudest disco sucks chant yet as the records were wheeled out on the field in a huge box strapped with dynamite. Now, Steve hadn't planned for this whatsoever. He thought nobody was going to show up, so he hadn't even bothered writing a speech. So he just started speaking from the heart, and this is what he had to say.
Oh.
Before setting off the explosives, Steve yelled through the loudspeakers, "Disco sucks, and we're never gonna let them forget it. They're not gonna shove it down our throats. We rock and rollers will resist. We will triumph." And again, if that sounds like any rhetoric that you have heard over the past couple of years,
I wonder why.
There you go. The box erupted as the dynamite went off, sending shards of records flying all over the stadium and starting fires in the field.
It blew, like, chunks of record, like, 200 feet into the air.
It, like, shot into the audience. They made a shrapnel bomb, is what the fucking idiots
yeah.
did. It shot discs, like, all into the audience and
stuff. IED, improvised explosive disco!
I guess you could call this a panic at the disco.
That's pretty good.
Shoddy burning fire on center field. But like in total, like tons of people were injured and stuff. There were like 36 injuries or something that night. Like people were seriously hurt.
Yeah, adrenaline cancels that out.
That's
they
true.
Still had a good time.
Bill Veeck watched in horror as a smoke cleared and he saw a crater in center field where the box had been moments before.
Now, I just like to interject here for a second because this is before the riot. Spoiler alert, there's a riot. But the field already has a giant fucking crater blown in it. You really thought that your maintenance crew was going to come out and patch that up real quick?
Yeah, really.
They you really thought that was going to be playable?
They got dirt blocks on deck, Nicole. Yeah. I wouldn't put that
they
too far.
They cancel games when it rains, let alone when there's a fucking pothole in the middle of the field.
Bill, he didn't really have much say in this. This wasn't his plan. This was Mike's plan, his
yeah.
son's plan. He's the one who organized all of this. Bill kind of heard about it and was pretty much powerless to stop it. Like, so many people were excited about this night that if they canceled it, like, they would have kind of screwed themselves out of all this money that they were about to make. And as the owner of the team, he had to make money. That was his one job.
Gotta pay your hospital bills somehow.
And so,
exactly.
Like, what was he gonna do? The night only got worse, though, as thousands of drunk men rushed the field, spreading the fires and causing chaos.
Definitely on some other substances, too.
Yes.
Because the announcers from inside of their, like, box were commenting on how strongly it smelled of marijuana in the stadium.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. Just to think of, like, all the shit going down, they're like, oh, man, Steve, there's a real overpowering odor of marijuana out here. Oh, yeah, it's crazy, Joe. I cannot believe it. Overpowering smell of marijuana and just fire everywhere. Fucking children screaming, nothing, just
children
nope.
screaming,
oh, just marijuana.
Bill rushed out to the field, but he could do nothing to stop the riot that was occurring. Bonfires raged in the outfield. People were climbing the foul line poles, literally stealing the bases.
Like, no, they never found home plate. They don't know what happened.
It's fucking Philly after the Super Bowl.
Yeah, that's what I thought of. People were fighting each other with baseball bats. They stormed the clubhouses, and they destroyed the dugouts. The few actual baseball fans that were there tried to leave, but remember, the gates had all been padlocked shut to keep thousands of fans out from the streets so they couldn't get out.
So the people that just wanted to get out of the fucking riot were trapped in there.
Now, Bill tried his best to calm things down, flashing the message, "Please return to your seats," on the scoreboard.
Because that'll work.
And they blasted, "Take me out to the ball game." But
nothing is more soothing.
Nothing has ever shut down a riot like, "Take me out to the ball game."
You know what they should have done?
How can you riot when that's on?
They should have activated the kiss cam. That would have fucking got everybody to look. Like, oh, shit, look at that.
Put all the rioters on kiss cam. "I'm not going to kiss him. No, I'm not going to kiss him."
Yeah, exactly. Or they just start all making out and everyone's friends at the end of that. You can't, you know, you're on the kiss cam. You got to do it.
You can't be homophobic if you're making out with your homies.
You can't be homophobic when you're on the kiss cam. All rules off.
That's true.
Well, obviously, none of this stuff worked. The two baseball teams were hiding out in their locker rooms, terrified of the mob that was right outside of the doors, but nobody paid any attention to the teams because nobody there gave a shit about baseball. They probably forgot that there was even a game going on.
Poor hopeful Dan was probably wet his
pants. They were just there for the explosion, and after the explosion happened, these people did not give a single fuck about the baseball that was still left to occur.
Well, which is crazy, because they could have just left. They didn't have to save the baseball.
All hyped up on drugs, and they were all drunk, and so after their explosion, they were like, "Well, now what?"
And so, let's storm the field!
They were all hyped up, and they
and
wanted something
yelled,
to do, so this
charge!
Was that. Yeah, basically. Eventually, the Chicago police had to be called in with full riot gear on to break up the mob.
They were, like, on horseback and shit.
What's half riot gear? What do you approach,
it's just
like,
the shield and, like, a bully stick. That's
I don't
it.
Know. This is a pretty low-threat scenario. I'm thinking quarter riot gear.
Yeah, you think just the knee pads?
Yeah.
Just maybe one knee pad, I think.
I don't want to get kicked in the shin, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
No, nobody dies. Oh, my God.
Never.
By the time the crowd was dispersed, the field had been decimated and deemed unplayable.
Who would have thought?
The White Sox were forced to forfeit the game, which is only the fourth time in modern baseball history that that had ever been done. The time previous to that had been the 10-cent beer night. So this was like the second time up to that point in history that a team had to forfeit a game.
Bro, that I think sucks. The funniest thing ever. Get a chance ever. To play the second game.
Yeah. I think the funniest thing ever is that like the White Sox tried to go and say like, "Oh, we can postpone, we can reschedule for Sunday." And then the like I think it was the manager of the Tigers was like, "No. According to the baseball rule book, a baseball game can only be postponed due to an act of God. And this riot is your fault, and therefore you have to forfeit." An act of God is what it takes to
this
postpone
was an act
a baseball
of Steve
game.
Dahl, so not good enough.
Well, I guess rain is an act of God. So.
Yeah,
exactly. That's what it meant, but they couldn't have just said like natural conditions or something. They had to be an act of God.
Yeah. And this night for the White Sox went down not only as one of the worst failures in baseball history, but it's still remembered today as just an outpouring of racist and homophobic fear. That's really what it was. And this story doesn't even really just end here.
I have a couple more kind of like things about more modern events, recent things that have happened. So Mike Vec, as you can remember, mm-hmm. the promotions guy for the White Sox, he was basically ruined. He was like blackballed in baseball for the longest time. And he eventually got himself back to be like the owner of a couple of minor league teams. And in July 2014, the Charleston River Dogs, who he is the president of, held a promotion involving the destruction of Justin Bieber and Miley Cyrus merchandise.
Do you not learn? Mike, you
so
dense motherfucker.
So what the fuck do you mean? Like, you didn't fucking learn? And not to mention, so this happened in 1979. Just 2 years ago in 2019 was the 40th anniversary of this event, and the White Sox held like a commemoration where people would show up and they gave out 10,000 free Disco Demolition t-shirts right on the heels of Pride Month, because this happened at the very beginning of July. So that's
dumbasses.
In real poor taste.
Bad
and they thought
move.
That was a good idea.
Bad move, White Sox.
And then they
bad
went
move.
Out and they were like, "Oh, we, you know, celebrate diversity and inclusion and blah, blah, blah." No, you don't.
We'll give everyone a Disco Demolition shirt. We don't care who it is.
Yeah, you can't even apologize for this horrible event that, like, And Steve Dahl, like, I think he's still alive today. Like,
yeah, he is.
He still vehemently denies that he had this had anything to do with racism, homophobia, misogyny, anything.
Steve, you organized the whole fucking thing, you moron.
He's like, well, that's not what we thought. We just hated disco. Yeah, why? Why did you hate disco?
You know, disco
so much?
Isn't spelled the same as racism. That's kind of weird.
Yeah, I
because
don't know.
It had everything to do with looking nice and presentable and empowering people that aren't white men.
One of Steve's whole thing was like, oh, all these like disco guys in their three-piece suits. I just want to wear jeans and like a concert t-shirt.
Because that's
then
acceptable
fucking,
in the rock
do
community.
That, Steve, and you enjoy your life and leave other people the fuck alone, you little old piece of shit.
Yeah, I wear
sweatpants. You can't just leave well enough alone.
I'm going to start bullying the shit out of you because you dress nice and I wear sweatpants constantly. You fucking moron. I hate you. Go die.
That's all we've got for you this week. Thank you all for listening. We are nearing the end of the semester here at school, which means the end of season 2 is almost upon us.
Oh, goodness.
We've got a couple more episodes up our sleeves, but then we'll be taking the summer off. So feel free to go back and catch up on old episodes while we're not making new ones. And tell your friends about us. I feel like we're shareable.
Shareable.
Yeah, where did
shareable.
Yeah, it's not shareable.
Cool to share.
We can get passed around any circle.
Go toss us a follow on Instagram at Rule3333 and on Facebook at Rule3Podcast. And have a good week, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.